I would love to. Here's a quick overview. I want to explain who we are, who MAF is, some about Indonesia, some about where in Indonesia we are, and also encourage you in the Word this morning, and hopefully not bore you too much or go too long or anything like that as well. But I want to start with a verse. After Pastor Vic's prayer this morning, you know, it doesn't take long to feel overwhelmed by what goes on around us or in the world as well. And a verse that's been on my mind probably for a good part of 2025 so far is one from 1 Corinthians. And I'll figure this out. There we go. And it goes like this. This is Paul speaking at the end of chapter 15. And he says, "Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." I'm going to read it again. "Therefore, my beloved brothers and sisters, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." I find this verse like an encouragement, like someone coming along. Paul's coming alongside and encouraging other believers, but also thinking about it, it's a verse that takes a certain amount of trust. A trust in the Lord, a trust in the unknown, a trust in Him and knowing what it is He has called you to, and trusting Him with all those things that are outside of your control. And as Pastor Vic was listing those different things this morning, I was thinking about that. And I'm going to come back to this verse in a little bit. But first off, our family, this was in 2015, and I'll just explain a little bit. So this is as far as back I could, so that's 10 years ago. So we had a bunch of littles. The really little one, third from the right, is sitting right down there, Charlotte. And the other three are out and about. They're too big to come traveling with us now. Way back when I was probably 3 or 4, I found out about Mission Aviation Fellowship through being a little kid running around our little church in Revelstoke, BC, and somehow I got my name signed up to it. That's back in the old days, and you had evening services and projectors, and they would show film of missionary work. And I don't know why the Lord somehow I thought that was MAF was pretty cool from the missionary we heard about, and I got my name signed up in the newsletter. Fast forward about 20 years. I've been in the Lower Mainland for a number of years going to school. I was working in Vancouver and attending this church. And as Duncan had mentioned, Amy and I had been newly married in 2002. We were living right over on Windsor Street. And I was working in an office at an engineering firm and just feeling discontented about what I was doing and felt like, man, Lord, what do I do? I'd love to go back and work with my hands. I don't like being in an office. What do I do? And we were praying about it. And through a series of events, the Lord, in that basement suite in Windsor, kind of showed Amy and I that I actually got a newsletter that was forwarded from my dad that I'd signed up. My name had gotten in the sign-up list 20 years before. And I was thinking about what it would be to be an aircraft mechanic. And working at the airport or something. And I got a newsletter saying, MAF needs aircraft mechanics really bad. We need aircraft mechanics. And this light bulb went on to both Amy and I that we could actually do missions with a professional, with a trade, so to speak. I didn't look at myself as being a pastor or a teacher or a linguist or anything like that. So I thought, well, that's what, you know, mission works for us, for those kind of people. So that was in 2002. In 2004, we packed up and we left Vancouver and we moved up to Dawson Creek, way up in northeast BC. I did schooling there for a year and a half. In 2005, we moved to Prince George and we started a family. Bought a home. I worked there for 5 years, and then we felt the Lord continually bringing back this idea of moving overseas and serving with MAF, as myself as an aircraft mechanic. And that eventually really got rolling in 2010. And MAF we made the decision to put us in Indonesia. So in 2011, we moved to Indonesia. And we've been there, I mean, obviously back on furloughs, but we've been in Indonesia ever since. And if I fast forward this, that's in 2023. That's the most recent professional photo I have, my family. And I do have this is last fall. This is the five of us. Luke had already moved back from Indonesia, so that's in Sentani. So I also want to talk a bit about what is MAF. MAF is essentially a group of believers who have the vision and heart to see isolated people change by the love of Christ. And as hinted in the name, Mission Aviation Fellowship, that is through aviation as a platform, using aviation as a tool to accomplish this. And I want to go back a little bit about the history of MAF, where this came out of. If you can imagine, about 80 years ago, would that be 80 years ago? 60? Yeah, about 80 years ago, 2025, you have all these young men and also women coming out of the war experience in World War II. And a lot of them were believers, and some of them had gained skills that they wanted to put to use. And it's actually really interesting to think that through war, mankind really sharpens their technology with the intent of killing each other, right? With the intention of conquering each other. And actually, it's through World War II that aviation really moved forward with leaps and bounds. But you had these young men and young women who came out of the war with pilot experience, mechanical experience in aviation, and wanted to apply that trade. Well, leading up to World War II, there was a growing need around the world as missions went global and went into some really hard to reach places, that aviation was a really useful tool. But as you can imagine, if you just do aviation on the side and you make a mistake, aviation isn't very forgiving. And there are actually incidences where missionaries were killed trying to fly planes. And so just kind of like a doctor would do with like Doctors Without Borders or something, if you have a professional who can focus on doing one area of work and allow somebody to do something else. And so young men and young women started getting together, and that's when MAF was created. This young woman here, Betty Green, was actually one of MAF's first pilots. And she actually served in a group called Women Air Force Service Pilots, WASP, during World War II. So she came out of World War II with some flying experience. And she actually flew MAF's first flight in 1946, that would be 79 years ago, from Los Angeles down to Mexico to move two Bible translators with Wycliffe. Another person you might have heard of, one of the early pilots, is Nate Saint. And in 1949, he was the first pilot stationed at MAF's first overseas base in Shell, Ecuador. And I'm going to touch base a little more on that story. Many of you might be familiar with his story and the story of the five missionaries down there. Today, though the heart, mission, and vision is the same, MAF is totally changed. As you can imagine, in 80 years, how much the world has changed, how much aviation has changed, how much the needs have changed. And so we serve in a number of different countries around the world. With, I think it's around 1,500 different partner organizations. And that's one of the key things for MAF is that what we're about is enabling a lot of times other organizations to accomplish what they need to accomplish. We're not doctors, but doctors can't get into a certain place, we allow them to get into place and they can do their medical work. We're not Bible translators. But without MAF, a lot of Bible translators cannot get in and out of the area that they're living and working, and so on. Globally, we have about 130 aircraft around the world. It's a giant, you could put it this way, kind of like a giant professional bush plane organization with professional bush pilots flying small aircraft. Okay, Indonesia, I want to tell you a little bit about this country. I did not know a whole lot about this country before I found out I was moving to it. There's about, I think it's the fourth most populous country in the world with about 275 million people, behind India, China, the US, and then Indonesia, believe it or not. So that's about maybe seven times the population of Canada. 18,000 plus islands, and I heard an old Indonesian make a joke once that it really depends on if it's high tide or low tide how many islands Indonesia has. It's somewhere between 80 to 90%. The majority religion there is Islam. However, a lot of Indonesians are moderate in how they view their belief and how they practice it. And as I'll explain in a bit, Papua is less influenced by Islam than other parts of Indonesia. And there's, if you can imagine, a ton of islands. You can have a lot of ethnic groups that develop over time. And if you take all of it, the archipelago of Indonesia, there, I've read somewhere there's 700 plus different language groups there. And it's unique in the sense that Indonesia, growing up in Canada in kind of a first world country, and you move to a more developing country, there are massive cities there with a lot of wealth, and there are also areas of great poverty and areas of great isolation that totally lack infrastructure. And it's kind of hard to wrap your head around a little bit when you come from Canada, but that's the reality that they live with. And so when you fly into a place like Jakarta, it's just a sea of urban sprawl and people. And you're like, how could there ever be jungle where you need an airplane in this country? But there is, if you go to certain areas of it. We, in 2011, we first moved and did language school to the island of Java. That's where that arrow is pointing. Java is quoted as the most populated island in the world, with over 150 million people living on that island. And then we spent just about 8 years up in northern part of Borneo. The majority of that island of Borneo is Indonesia. We lived in a province called North Kalimantan and a town called Tarakan for just about 8 years. And then 2020, we repositioned and moved to the left-hand side of the island of New Guinea. So that's Australia below there, New Guinea above. And the left-hand side is Indonesia, and the right-hand side is Papua New Guinea, which is an independent country. This is now the left-hand side of New Guinea, and these are our different bases that we have with MAF there. Our MAF program in Papua is quite large, so I'll tell you a little bit about Papua first. At 3.5 million people, it's quite underpopulated compared to most areas. It's quite a large chunk of land, so just that left half is about 44% the size of BC. And right through the middle, it has a pretty formidable mountain range going from the left all the way to the right-hand side of the island. And on the top and the bottom, you have these kind of vast jungle lowlands with the meandering rivers and the snakes and the crocs and all that kind of stuff you think about when you think about jungles. But in the middle, in the mountains, you have very steep mountains. You have mountains reaching 15, 16,000 feet. So the highest peak there, Puncak Jaya, which is in Papua, is the highest point in Southeast Asia. And it's about 3,000 feet higher than Mount Robson. So it's the only mountain in Southeast Asia that has a little bit of a snow cap on it, believe it or not. So when you think of jungles, there's also some quite formidable highlands. And that's part of why there's such a lack of infrastructure in this island. A little bit about our program here. We have, give or take a couple, 35 different expat MAF families just in Papua. We are one of them. I've spent a number of my years in Indonesia working as aircraft mechanic or managing all the maintenance for our planes, but in the last 2.5 years, I became the program director for this program. So my main role with MAF is actually oversight, leadership, helping new families get set up, helping oversee the budget, helping steer our program to keep on target with our vision and mission with MAF. We currently have about 10 aircraft, not about, we have 10 aircraft. One of them is being returned to airworthiness. In other words, it had a lot of work to be done on it. And we have about 100 active airstrips. I don't know if you can see very good in that picture. I actually threw another one and just you can see a bird's eye view. So this is a random Papuan village named Angruk. The reason I took this photo, it's from the plane flying overhead, but a massive landslide had happened the night before, and just about the town just about went down the hill. So there's probably close to somewhere between a 500 and 1,000 foot drop between that town and where that creek is, up in the corner there. An entire part of the mountain had sloughed off in the night. Thankfully, nobody was killed. But that little airstrip there is very typical of what we're flying in and out of, with big mountains on the left and right and that kind of thing. That particular one is fairly flat to start with, but at the end it goes up to almost a 20% slope. And a lot of the airstrips that we're flying in and out of look more like, have anybody here skied? Gone skiing, you know, the green circle, the blue square, the black diamond. You know, a green circle run is like the road you go down, whatever. I used to grow up skiing in Revelstoke, and I got atop a couple strips, and I'm like, this is kind of like a T-bar run. Like, it's steep enough that you could ski down the runway. They usually start up sometimes 18, 19% and level out to 12 or 13%. So when you take off in a little plane, you go over this bench, and as soon as you go over the edge, you're committed, and you're racing down the hill. And it's like you're going off a ski jump into this valley. It's quite something. And it depends when you talk to linguists, they might differ on the number, but around just our left half of the island in Papua, we have around 275 distinct language groups, which is really unique. New Guinea is known around the world as a really unique linguistic island. There are so many different linguistic, and we're not talking just like, oh, a few words are different. We're talking languages that are different from as far as English is to German, at least that different. And you have 275 plus of those languages just on this island. It's hard to wrap your head around. You could have one group of people in a couple of villages on one side of the valley, and you go way down a steep valley, and you go 5-6 miles down over there and around the corner, and there's another group there, and they speak in a completely different language, and you can just about see them. Okay, what does it look like with MAF serving there? And I talked about showing the love of Christ to isolated people. And one of those ways, obviously, with an airplane is to physically be of help. And so transportation in and out of these places is paramount for a number of reasons. And one of those is just basic medevacs. And I just threw a bunch of photos in here as kind of examples of what we might see in a given month. This is some guy who's being helped on an airplane. I think he had an axe wound, so he had probably like self-inflicted when he's working in his garden or something like that. Hurt his leg badly enough and is infected, and he needed to get out of there, or else he would have died. can't see it very well, but this young woman had issues in childbirth. If you can imagine, you don't have a hospital, any nurses, any nursing station. If a mom's giving birth, a young mom, and there's complications, what do you do, right? Well, there's not a whole lot you can do in the jungle. Other than to fly her out and try to get her to a hospital where a lot of the basic medical care that you and I take for granted is just not available. So this young mom is being flown out, and I do not know how that story ended with that mom and that baby, but this is something that happens regularly. It's another example. The guy with the light, he looks like he's doing dentistry work. He's a dentist. His name is Miguel. And we flew him. We sometimes fly professionals like him in to a village to do work on teeth, to places where there's not a whole lot of toothbrushes or toothpaste or dental floss, and there's no dentist. So can you imagine these poor kids or people that are dealing with toothaches and that kind of thing? This is a photo. You can see Miguel in the back there being himself, but see the little kid on the left-hand side going, ah, he's not just goofing off. He's trying to show you his tooth he got yanked out. So he had some infected tooth. He's like, look, this is what the work I had done. And a lot of it's done without anesthetic. Can you believe it? Like Papuans are very, very hardy. Can you imagine like dealing with a toothache as much as like you can't wait for someone to yank it out of your mouth and likely there wasn't any freezing or anything like that. And he's got a big smile on his face. That's really impressive. Sometimes we also bring the medical professionals in. This young guy is with Siloam Clinics, which is an Indonesian kind of professional mission that MAF enables to get into different villages, and they're stationed in a number of villages, and sometimes we'd fly them into different locations so they can come in and do the medical work there. And I only have a couple photos. There's this photo here and this one here. And what this is of is the first one was some teachers, and these are in two different villages. And the second one is some kids. And in about close to a dozen schools, SLH, Sekolah Lentera Harapan. So they're Lantern of Hope schools would be the English translation. And they are as well a kind of a Christian mission, but done with professionals. So these young Indonesians come out of education, and they come from places like Jakarta, like the big city. And part of their funding for this school is that they go out to these extremities, these far-off pioneer corners of their country to serve in these schools with these little Papuan kids. And we fly these teachers in and out, and when needed, we'll fly the students in and out as well. And these schools are enabled by works like MAF as well. And these are kids that would not get an education any other way. If there was a government school put up there, a lot of times they'll build a building and you go in there and it's boarded up and there's no teachers. So sometimes these boys are 12, 13 years old. They're leaving their parents and going into the city to look for work. The girls, 12, 13, 14 years old, are usually being married off at that point. With the school, it gives them, it changes that dynamic and it starts to change that culture, and they start to get a foundation of an education and some influence as well in discipleship. Connected to spiritual our physical isolation is also spiritual isolation. We do a lot of flying to support the Indonesian, the local Papuan church there as well, different denominations. Evangelistic work they're doing or just the churches within there. If you can imagine, well, I think I'm a great example of what I'm about to say. The need to be to physically move around and be located near each other. We flew back to Canada so that we could reconnect with family and friends and churches. It's why we're here right now, to speak to you guys, to connect with you and share the work that we're doing and to mutually encourage each other. If you can imagine being in a little village, and it's just Mountain View Church, and you have no connection with anybody else in your denomination, the pastors have no connection with other pastors, none of the leadership get any training, there's no interaction at all, because you're physically isolated from each other, it's very, very difficult, and it's not good. And so one of the main things we're able to do is to support the church and allowing pastors to go to conferences, people to get in and out of their village, and to cross-pollinate with other churches and people in other churches, other villages, sorry. Isolation, spiritual isolation from God's word. If you remember me speaking about how many languages there are, a lot of mission work for a couple generations, I'm going to speak more on that in a bit, has been Bible translation work. There are currently about 40 New Testaments that have been completed in individual Papuan languages, and out of the 40 of those, about 10 of them are complete full Bibles. We've actually been really spoiled in the last 2 years. There have been a number of those translation works have come to completion, and when they do, they have a huge celebration. It's really neat. And this is a photo of that here where boxes of Bibles have been flown in for the Bible dedication, and the community is having a massive celebration that usually goes for days as they celebrate the finishing of this work. Out of those, think about that. That's 40 New Testaments, 275 languages. Not every one of those languages need a translation work because some of them are dying off as the parents get older. But there's a lot of work yet to be done on both sides of the island in this type of linguistic work. And it's not a short-term thing. It's not something you come whip out in a few months or a couple years either. And I'll explain that in a bit here. Well, I'm going to explain a little bit more. So some of our friends have spent 10-plus years in the village of Bina with the Dem people. And I put this photo on the side. This is a few years ago. Some MAFers went in on a long weekend, and we helped fly in tin roof and all that and supplies. And they needed to build a big, giant covering because in that 10 years, these families with Ethnos 360, they had to get established in the community, make some relationships. They needed to start to learn the local dialect and language that nobody else knows. Once they start to learn the language, they need to start learning how to create a written language out of that. Right now they also need to take some of their maybe the most promising locals, Dem people from there, and start teaching them how to read their own language that they know. And once you've taught that, then you can begin some Bible translation. And there's this long ongoing process of relationship building, being present in the community, learning the language, teaching literacy, and so on. And it takes a long time. And after about 10 years, they were at the place where they had translated enough, they were ready to start telling the story of the Bible. And they were going to start at Genesis. And so they needed a place where everybody could gather, because it wasn't just the one village. It was anybody who spoke the Dem language that would come from all around to see it. And this is a photo of that same place, loaded. There was people standing outside, coming to hear the story of the Bible, starting in Genesis in their own heart language. I don't know how many of you know a second language somewhat. Show of hands. This is a pretty multicultural congregation. If you're like me, I can get by my Indonesian. I've been working at it for 14 years. But if I'm going to read scripture or I want to understand something, it is really difficult to read an Indonesian Bible and to grasp what is going on. I got to go to the English. There are a lot of people around the world that have been taught scripture in a language that is not their own heart, their first language. It's their second language or third language. And it's really hard to grasp. And I've heard a lot of stories about people's like, in Papua, they've been years hearing something in Indonesian or another tribal language that is over the mountains. And then when they hear it for the first time in their own language, it's like the light bulb goes on. They understand. They get what's going on. What is that scripture? Those who have not, I won't even quote it. It was early in Romans. You have to be able to hear and see and read the word of God to understand it, right? I want to swing back with that idea of like the long-term investment here. And this guy right here is Jim Elliott, and he was another a buddy of Nate Saint's with a different org. He's one of the missionaries that Nate Saint was flying around. And there was five of them in Ecuador at that time. And this is part of his journal, and he has a quote there. Let me catch up on my notes. He has a quote that he made famous, but I think it comes from, if you've ever looked up any commentators, an old Scottish commentator named Matthew Henry, like 1600s. Well, his dad was a preacher, and Philip Henry, and he said this, and I'm not going to try to do an English accent. He is no fool who parts with that which he cannot keep, when he is sure to be recompensed with that which he cannot lose. So in Jim Elliot's diary, he had written, he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. I'm not even sure how old Jim was there. Maybe, I don't know if he's in his late 20s, early 30s, those guys. Bunch to me, now that's seeming pretty young. This is a pretty heavy quote coming from a guy who was martyred. Him along with Jim Elliot, Ed McCauley, Peter Fleming, Roger Yoderman, and Nate Sain. If you know the story of those five went in to meet with the Warani people in Ecuador, and they were trying to build a relationship with these people that no one else had any contact with. And it went south, and for whatever reason, and while there are reasons you can read about that they found about afterwards, a war party came along one time after a couple friendly greetings and killed all five of them. And so that's a pretty heavy price. He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep. For him, it was his life in the prime of his youth to gain what he cannot lose. And I think it's worth, you know, in our heart of hearts, we at least ask with anything, whether it's our life or anything, is it worth it? Was it really worth it? In Jim Elliot's case, was he correct? Or was he a fool? Like you said, he is no fool. Or was he a fool? I want to share with you a passage of scripture. It's a parable. But if you've got a short attention span, let's say you're Gen Y and you're used to looking at Instagram, it's only one verse long. But I love it. We're gonna dwell on it just a little bit. The kingdom of heaven, this is Jesus speaking. He's describing something to a people who don't understand something, which he is from, right? The kingdom of heaven is like this. It is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and then covered up. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has, and he buys that field. So what is the kingdom of heaven like? It's like this vast, unmeasurable treasure, something far, far more valuable than anything you have. Well, this man has anyways in the parable, right? And in his joy when he discovers it, it's not like reluctantly. He doesn't reluctantly go back and weigh it up. In his joy, he goes back and he sells it all. He gets rid of it all. He puts it all out there because he's all about that one treasure he's going after. I want to make three just short points on that. And the first one is, you are worth it. The commentators I read on this agree that the first application for this is that actually Christ is talking about himself. He's talking about either his perspective of the Father or as the Son, that Jesus is the man, the story, who gives up a great worth to obtain something he deemed of great value. And that thing of great value was us. It's myself, it's you guys, it's the world. He longs to restore us to himself. But this was costly, right? To bridge this gap was very, very costly. From the perspective of the Father, it was giving up whom he loved most, to give up his Son. There's nothing more he could have given up. From the Son, it was giving up his rightful position and his life. But God deemed it worthwhile. His sacrifice was costly, but he deemed myself, he deemed you guys, he deemed all of us worthy of it. My second point is that he's worth it. And he is worthy, both the value we have, who we are, and the value we assign to each other comes from and flows out of who God is. It comes from the character of God, his love for us. This is foundational, where it all comes from. Our Creator loves us dearly and offers us everything he has through his Son. He is worthy. And really, the fact that he says we're worth it, described in his, is an example. It's an illustration. It's an opening up of our eyes of his character, of who he is, that he loves us. Why does he love us? Because he chose to love us. Why do we have worth? Because God chose to give us worth, right? A passage in talking about being worthy in Revelation 5. Then I looked and I heard around the throne and the living creatures and the elders, the voice of many angels, numbering myriads of thousands of thousands and thousands, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." And I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them saying, "To him who sits on the throne and the Lamb be blessed and honor and glory and might forever and ever." Such a beautiful passage. I think our own self-worth is directly connected to our ability to believe and trust who God is and who he says we are and who he is, first of all. And if he's worthy and he's worth our sacrifice, and we believe and we trust that we are worth it, well, then they are worth it, other people. This is kind of like the greatest commandment and the second commandment, right? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, everything you have. And the second is like it, love others as you love yourself. They are worth it. If God deems us worth it, so should we deem others with the same value. So if you look at this story again, this is also an application to us, right? Do we value God, and do we value the desire of relationship with him like he values us? As Christ said in Matthew 6, where your heart is, there your treasure will be also. Where's our treasure? If we value him, we will value others just as he values them. That means I'm worth it, you're worth it, the people down the street, the Filipino community right down here on Fraser is worth it. The myriads and numerous different cultures and language groups that live in a funny little corner of the world like Papua, they're worth it. They're worth the effort, right? But practically, how do you know sometimes if your effort is worth it? If you believe that, like, you know, Lord, I believe that you value me and that you love me and that you deem me worth of what the cost you had, and I value others. But it's hard to see more than two steps in front of yourself sometimes, right? It's hard to put together whether or not what you're doing has value in the greater kingdom a lot of times. And that's the whole trust thing, as I mentioned earlier in that first passage we looked at. And to kind of like encourage you with that and to connect with the work that's going on in Papua, I want to tell a bit of a story that spans over 60 years in Papua that involves many different people. But sometimes in hindsight, God opens and allows you to see what he's doing amongst all of us, different organizations, different cultures, different people. This here is a picture of Ed and Shirley Maxey. Another black and white. I got lots of old folders, don't I? Ed and Shirley Maxey is a young couple. They moved into central Papua, a place called the Balim Valley, nowadays known as Waman as the city in there, as some of the pioneer first missionaries into Papua as a young couple. In the early 1960s, a few years in, they really felt the calling to go out to some of the neighboring people groups around in the mountains. This valley is surrounded by these high mountains. And what they needed to do, there's no airstrips to go in there, maybe just some Papuan trails. They basically had to hike in into unknown territory. And this is a time where, you know, Papuans had killed Westerners already. So Ed and one other guy went hiking on a trail over these mountains to a place to the Ngalik people where they knew. And there was this village called Silimo. And when he got there, when he was arriving in the area, he had, unbeknownst to him, a bunch of the locals had seen him and said, "Who are these pale-faced invaders? We got to get rid of them." And so they were hiding basically in the bush, kind of watching as he went along, and there at any moment they were going to jump out and they were going to kill them. Well, Ed, he got to where he wanted to go, and I heard someone describe, his son described, as like he just kind of, there was like a puddle or something, and he was just so tired, he threw himself down right in the puddle. It's like, oh, I'm just imagining, like, you know, maybe a little bit in humor, like, I've made it, but just lying there trying to cool off. And these Papuans who are in the bush did not know what this crazy white guy was doing, throwing himself down in the mud, and they had no idea how to react. They thought he was mad, so they just walked out and greeted them. And through this little funny act, actually, that's how the Lord used to spare his life that day. And they began a relationship with those people. His family moved in there. And he began learning the local language and all those things I was telling you about with that people group. And so over a series of decades, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and the late 80s, his son, so that's Buzz and Myrna back, as you can tell from the clothes, that'd be the late 80s, early 90s. Buzz grew up there, and he moved back with the same mission to continue working. And Shirley Maxey, one of the things she said, so they saw the New Testament over 30-plus years to complete translation amongst those people. But she said, "One of my biggest regrets is we never finished the Old Testament." And so from that time on, in the 90s, Buzz and Myrna, they took it upon as one of their things to continue working on this translation work. But not alone. These two guys here, this is an older photo, but that's Amos and Enos. And they were two Ngalik men who really excelled in the language part and became key Bible translators. And so over a series of decades, what they would do is these guys, they were living outside of Silimo. They would go into Silimo for a number of weeks, and they would start working through different Old Testament books. And they would handwrite. This is in the 90s and early 2000s. You couldn't just get on your smartphone or whatever, do something like that. They would handwrite as they translated the scripture into their own language. They would handwrite it all out. And then, I think I have a photo here. Then they would fly that package, that very valuable cargo out. It would then get mailed or airmailed, whatever, back to Calgary, Alberta, of all places. And there was a church there, and there was a crew there that when they'd then put this into software, they would put into through a software program, write it all out, get it saved digitally, and then it would go back, and I think linguists would look through it and test it. And I think this cycle, I think I heard Buzz said sometimes it happened at least three times for every passage of scripture. And flying it in and out. This is a photo. This is about 10 or 11 years ago. So this is before we were in Papua, but I did language school with a couple of those pilots, mechanics and pilots. And they're holding, it was the last passage. This is the last packet coming out of Silimo to go get checked that had flown in on that airplane. And so of all the little things, all the hundreds of kilos of cargo that came on that flight, that little thing, when they heard that, they stopped and they took a photo of it. It was pretty cool. Well, this continued on. And this past spring, Amy and I had the privilege of going down with a lot of other mission orgs to take part in this collective effort of completing this. And we had in a village called Dakai, and then also in Silimo, they had the Bible dedications just this past spring. Was it March? I can't remember. Yeah, in March. And so I grabbed this photo, And this was at the big celebration in Dakai. There's about 1,000 people there. But Papuans are they like illustrations. They like acting out things. Those couple in the white shirts, they're acting out the story of Ed Maxey and his buddy being really tired and throwing themselves down on the ground. And the other guys in the black shirts are the locals who are about to kill them and like, what's going on? And so they were acting this all out at the Bible dedication. It was pretty neat. This is a photo of the guy with the big hat on and speaking, and he speaks in Gaelic fluently, is Buzz Maxey. And he's our neighbor, and we've been able to hear some of these stories from him. He's in his 60s now, but he's speaking to the crowd at the dedication. I'm not sure which one it is, but if you see those two older Papuan guys behind him, one of those two guys was a young man in the warring party that intended on killing Buzz's dad in the early 60s. And there he is at the Bible dedication. Was it about a half a year ago, I had written this verse, this same verse I read to you earlier, on my whiteboard. I think I heard somebody else quote it. Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. This was actually, and Buzz came in, he's like, that's one of my favorite verses, and he got talking about it. And I think it's totally applicable. When you think about this story, the old Ed and Shirley Maxey have died of old age. They never lived to see the New Test or the Old Testament finished, this work they had been part of. Many different people, many different organizations, many different believers had been involved in this story with the Gaelic people up to this point. The Lord knows the whole picture. We don't often know the whole picture. And I think a lot of times what God is calling us to is continual faithfulness. It's the day in, day out, steadfastness, trusting him when you don't know what like the next week or next month is going to look like, or there are discouragements and you're not sure, am I having an effect, right? And this is what I'm more speaking to you what I've been convicted and encouraged of in the last while. And if you look at it with that last parable, there is a man who found this treasure of great value, and he went with joy back and he gave up everything he had to gain that one field, that one treasure. Therefore, brothers and sisters, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord, your work in the Lord is not in vain. And I want to end with that, but I want to send some prayer requests your way. One of the struggles we have in Papua in the last few years, and my 5 years there, has been an increase in security issues. You can Google it, Papua Independence Movement, but it's been going since the 1960s, but it's flared up more and more. And kind of an incidental thing, I don't know if they would have really intended to affect us like this, but in 2021, we had a pilot basically kidnapped for 24 hours and our plane was burned right on the ramp. He's yanked out of his plane, and it's very, they're very volatile. And it's a lot of misdirected efforts sometimes by not very good people. And it doesn't take a lot to really affect things. So security through our whole area that we like to fly, and we want to fly, is really affected by this independence movement or the lack of security because of it. And as MAF, we're there to serve the people. We're there to reflect Jesus Christ and to love on people as Christ loves us. And we balance this fine line of avoiding suspicion from the military. Are you helping the independence movement? Or suspicion from the independence movement, like you're not flying military around, that kind of thing. And so we are always balancing this level of like risk and security in the areas that we go into. This guy was he worked for another commercial operator, but he was all over the news. He was kidnapped I can't remember, maybe 2022, and over a year and a half, he was living in the jungle. I cannot believe he survived with these guys, and he was released. He was a New Zealander, if I'm correct. His name was Philip. It was a real answer to prayer to have him out. But this is the island that we operate in. That it's tough, and we're trying to weigh that continually. So we'd ask you to pray for peace in that regards. I'd also ask for prayer just in an ever-changing world and a modernizing world. We're a nonprofit organization. We operate like a commercial operation, and aviation is full of regulations. So we really balance this fine line of being able to operate within the regulations as written. And we're constantly seeking discernment of, should we go fully commercial and be it more business as ministry? At some point, I think we'll have to, or do we continue like we are? So we would just pray for discernment, how MAF can continue to operate and accomplish its vision and mission in a place like Papua. I just put that there. That's me and with my maintenance crew, or some of the maintenance guys in Sentani. I mentioned before, I'm the program director, so I live and work out of an office a lot more, although sometimes I just want to go get my tools out and just work with tools instead of people sometimes. but our family as well, we would share with you that our family, any MAF family, career family, we're fully supported by churches and friends and people and individuals in churches financially and through prayer. And we need to increase our support level as well. So if that is something that interests you in partnering with us in our work with MAF, let me just go, oops, I skipped. There's a QR code there. So in the last few years, I've had to learn how to use QR codes. So if you're old, you can just come back and get a prayer card. Older than me, or my age or older. Shall I say wise and discerning, not old, right? But if you're younger, you can just hit that as well and get more information of how you can become part of our support team as well. But really appreciate you guys. I love this church. You guys are part of our story and how the Lord called Amy and I to the field. Thank you for letting me share this morning.